I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Two gatherings this week in Baltimore will focus on bringing more investment dollars and social capital to the city to grow our economy, create jobs, and stabilize some of our most distressed neighborhoods. Today, in conjunction with the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, the Johns Hopkins University 21st Century Cities Initiative convenes experts to consider how to reinvent our communities. Then on Wednesday, another group of prominent Baltimore natives returns to Charm City to learn about business opportunities in the first ever Baltimore Homecoming. Mary Miller is a senior fellow at Hopkins and the former Undersecretary for Domestic Finance in the Treasury Department. Nate Lowenthal and J.M. Shapiro are the founders of Baltimore Homecoming. They join me to talk about investing in Baltimore when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. Hope you had a good weekend. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. This week, two important gatherings are taking place in Baltimore that will explore ways to increase investment in small businesses and other ventures that will help the city grow its economy. Today, tomorrow, and Wednesday, the Johns Hopkins 21st Century Cities Initiative, in conjunction with the Federal Reserve of Philadelphia, will host a conference called Investing in Opportunity. And later this week, the first Baltimore Homecoming will launch. It's an effort to identify prominent people with Baltimore roots, bring them back home for a few days, and acquaint them with companies and causes that they may find appealing. A little later in the program, I'll talk with the two founders of Baltimore Homecoming, but first, a conversation with Mary Miller. She was for many years a senior executive with T. Rowe Price before a stint at the U.S. Treasury during the Obama administration, where she served as the acting deputy treasury secretary and the undersecretary for domestic finance. She's now a senior fellow at Johns Hopkins University in the 21st Century Cities Initiative, and she serves on the host committee of Baltimore Homecoming. It's good to see you, Mary. Welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be here.
So we talked the last time you were here about a report that you did for you and your colleagues at the 21st Century Cities Initiative about the sort of overview of the lending and the financing situation in Baltimore. And you've got a new report that you just issued last month about the accessibility of capital and getting loans for small businesses. What did you want to achieve? What did you want to study? And what did you come up with?
Well, broadly, I think we're trying to just get the facts to understand the financial system in Baltimore. And I talk about it in the sense of how hospitable are we to growth in Baltimore? And how do we help small businesses in particular grow? Because they're really the lifeblood of an economy. Small businesses create more jobs than big businesses. And it's also true that there are many reasons why small businesses grow and fail and continue and not continue, but access to capital is one of the most important ingredients of a successful environment for economic growth. So at 21st Century Cities, last year we got interested in the question of how big is our financial system and how many dollars flow through that system to a small business. And what you quickly realize is in a city like Baltimore, you have startups, and they may be technology companies, they might be life sciences companies that are connected to the universities. And then you have the Main Street businesses that are the restaurants and services that are vital to the city. And they need different kinds of capital. At times, a startup needs equity capital, very high risk venture capital to help them promote and develop an idea. On the other hand, a Main Street business may just need working capital to meet payroll and to buy inventory and to keep the doors open for their business. So we did a broad look last year at the size and scale of the financial system. And this year we've gone back and we're publishing two reports. One is already out. The first is on working capital or small business lending in Baltimore. And the second, which is about to come out, is on venture capital. So it's sort of a deeper dive into the dynamics of those two kinds of financial support for small companies here.
Mary Miller is a senior fellow at the Johns Hopkins 21st Century Cities Initiative. We are streaming our conversation on the WIPR Facebook page, and a little bit later in the broadcast, we will take your calls and comments. You gave some testimony to a committee hearing that Senator Cardin held. Here was a field hearing held over at Morgan State last month, because today's the 1st of October. And it's interesting, 50,000 small businesses in Baltimore. That just seems like a lot. What is it? How do you define a small business? What does that mean?
Well, traditionally, the definition is a business with fewer than 500 employees. But that's really way too high to talk about the number of businesses and employees in Baltimore. Of those 50,000, about 37,000 and a half are sole proprietorships, so a single individual who's incorporated or started a business. About 12,500 report more than one employee, and the bulk of those have fewer than 50 employees. But the definition is fewer than 500, and we've used that for our research and work. But in the main, these are pretty small companies.
So that could be anybody from a person who owns a flower shop to maybe a freelance writer or an actor or somebody who is a consultant to various companies and works out of her home maybe and you know, doesn't have an office and employees and all that kind of stuff. In terms of the impact on employment, because so many of these are sole proprietorships, I guess you call it when you're when you're a person working for yourself and with yourself. We always hear that small businesses are the main animating force for employment in the city. So are there enough small businesses that do have, you know, 5, 10, 15, 50 employees that are and they're having a palpable impact on the economy?
Yeah, so we were mainly interested in the 12,500 small businesses that have more than one employee. And we're particularly interested in how they access the financial system and whether they're able to borrow and whether they're able to find capital for growth. So we're probably looking at a much smaller subset than that 50,000.
And is for a city of 610,000 people, which Baltimore is 12,500 small businesses that have a few employees each. Does that seem about the right number? I mean, would it be a good thing for Baltimore to have 15,000 businesses or 20,000 businesses like that?
Well, I mean, the data show that small businesses are the main source of job creation in the United States. So more essentially would be better. I think what you really want are businesses that are strong and healthy and that survive and will continue to grow and employ people. We did not do a comparative study, so this isn't comparing Baltimore to every other, you know, city in the country. But we do know that the labor force in Baltimore is about 330,000 people. I think that figure is from 2016. So we have big companies in Baltimore. I worked for a pretty big company in Baltimore at one time, but we also have many small businesses that have fewer than 50 employees, and that's that is a source of economic growth for the city.
So a small business needs a loan for, as you say, the restaurant or the startup or whatever, goes to a bank usually, right? I mean, banks, and this report that you've just come out with last month has a lot to do with the kinds of loans that banks are making or, in some cases, not making. What did you find about the banks and in terms of the assets they have to lend and their ability and willingness to lend it?
Yeah. So we were largely looking at what I call the formal financial system, which is the banking system. And that's not too hard to do because banks have to report both their deposits and they have to report their loans. And we looked at three ways that small businesses can get loans: through a deposit-taking bank in the city of Baltimore, through a non-deposit-taking bank, and that might be a bank from out of state or might be outside of Baltimore that is making loans to businesses in the city but doesn't have branches here and isn't taking deposits. And the third is a financial institution that offers credit cards to businesses. And an example of that would be American Express. So we really looked at those three things. What we were not measuring is online lending, which is becoming more important. But the online lenders typically are not regulated and don't have to report their data the same way the banks do. And what we saw is that small business lending from the formal banking system has really declined in Baltimore over the last 10 years, from about 450 million 10 years ago to about 300 million today.
But it's not because their deposits have declined.
Correct. That was a very interesting part of the study, which was that we saw deposits in the city of Baltimore doubling over the last 10 years from about $13 billion to about $26 billion at the same time that we saw small business lending decline by 30%. Now, I want to be perfectly clear in saying that banks make other kinds of loans. They make mortgages, they make large commercial loans. They may be making loans to other types of entities, but we were solely focused on small businesses. So we were looking at that. And as a percent of the deposits in Baltimore, is a really significant decline. So 10 years ago, about 2.5%, I guess it was 2.4% of the deposit base in Baltimore was going to small businesses. In 2016, it was 0.8%. So a pretty significant decline.
Now, 10 years ago, of course, was the financial collapse, Lehman Brothers, yeah. And, you know, AGI and all that stuff. You were certainly very involved in that. And a little bit later, we'll talk about your particular and unique perch in that crisis. But are the banks, when you look for reasons that they're taking in so many more deposits and giving out so fewer loans, did they get spooked during the crisis in 2008? And are they just, I mean, they're certainly much more timid about mortgages than they used to be because it was a real estate problem that, you know, occasioned the crisis. But are they equally timid about business for similar reasons?
Well, certainly I think banks are more conservative and more risk averse than they were before the financial crisis, and that's probably a good thing. It's also true that financial regulation post the crisis requires banks to hold more capital. So the banks would say we have to hold more capital against the loans that we make, and these loans are particularly, you know, inefficient for us to make. They're smaller. And what we've seen in Baltimore is not different from what's going on nationally in terms of banks having fewer branches, staffing these branches with fewer lending officers. The old, you know, model of you coming into the branch, sitting down and working with the loan officer, that's really changed. And I think that's a big explanation for a lot of this. It is more costly and less efficient for banks to make these small business loans. But that doesn't mean it isn't a problem because small businesses still need credit. We didn't see a decline in the number of small businesses in Baltimore, and we saw a big growth in deposits, but we saw a 30% drop in lending. And that's pushing businesses to tap their personal credit cards further. It's pushing them to go online and get some, in some cases, more expensive credit. And we need to think about ways to enliven and make it a more healthy environment to get capital and to get credit on reasonable terms.
And one of the things we talked about last time you were here is the importance of geography to all of this. Because when we look at some of the big banks here in Baltimore, Bank of America or PNC or M&T Bank, they are not headquartered here. They are headquartered in other places. Yeah. So what impact does that have when a bank, you know, which is whose corporate headquarters is in Charlotte, North Carolina, has a branch here in Roland Park or you know, the Inner Harbor that's thinking about making a loan to a local startup or a local business?
Mm-hmm. Well, we think that it makes a big difference because we looked at the relative amount of lending that the largest banks in Baltimore are doing today in what we call their home market or their headquarters city versus Baltimore. And what's happened over the last 10 years is a lot of our locally owned and operated banks have been bought by large national banks. And they have large deposit bases in their headquarters cities, and they're loaning more in those cities. So I think we've been hurt by the loss of locally headquartered banks as our banks have been bought up by national banks. We have been helped by some local banks that are good lenders in the city. We were very heartened to see Howard Bank, for example, which acquired First Mariner this year, move their headquarters into the city, and they have a much higher, you know, loan-to-deposit ratio in Baltimore. As you might expect, they're a local bank, they know the local market, and they don't have to go back to their headquarters to get permission to make a loan in Baltimore.
Yeah, and when someone from M&T Bank, which is headquartered in Buffalo, New York, goes back to her headquarters and says, okay, here's this business, I want to think about supporting it, how are they going to know in, mm-hmm. in Buffalo, New York, what's really going on in Baltimore? I mean, it's virtually impossible. So that's interesting because we think about, you know, business being this global enterprise and everything's mm-hmm. global and everything's done online and, you know, but the actual physical location of the bank and the physical location of those loan mm-hmm. officers really matters a lot.
Another thing we took a look at was a 40-year-old law called the Community Reinvestment Act, which says if you're a financial institution taking deposits in a geographic area, you need to loan back into that market. And we were interested in seeing how much measurement we could get. You know, for Baltimore City, the deposit base we just talked about has doubled, but lending has gone down. And it turns out that banks have a lot of discretion in picking their assessment areas to be measured on their lending activity, and they usually choose their headquarters city as their primary market. So that's another way that we're disadvantaged.
Mary Miller served as the Undersecretary for Domestic Finance in the Treasury Department during the Obama administration. Prior to her work in government, she was for 26 years at T. Rowe Price here in Baltimore, and she is currently a senior fellow at the Johns Hopkins University 21st Century Cities Initiative. We'll have more with Mary Miller when we come back from a quick break. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you have a question or a comment for Mary Miller, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, and to find us on Twitter @MiddayWYPR. You can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, it's Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. By one shocking estimate, someone in the United States becomes a victim of sexual assault every 98 seconds. Nearly one out of five women will experience sexual assault in college. So in the shadow of the Brett Kavanaugh Supreme Court nomination fight, Dr. Sherry Parks joins me to discuss sexual violence on college campuses and how a new policy on college sexual misconduct that's being proposed by Education Secretary Betsy DeVos could radically change how allegations of sexual assault are reported and investigated. So we'll take all that up with Sherry Parks tomorrow here on Midday. If you're just joining us today, my guest is Mary Miller. She's the former Undersecretary for Domestic Finance at the U.S. Treasury and a senior fellow at Johns Hopkins University 21st Century Cities Initiative. We're talking about investing in Baltimore. A little later, I'm going to speak with two founders of a nonprofit called Baltimore Homecoming about their efforts to find people willing to invest in local companies and causes. A recent report co-authored by Mary Miller for the 21st Century Cities Initiative at Hopkins chronicles how much lending banks are doing for local businesses. We've got a link to that report on our website at wypr.org/midday. And if you'd like to be part of our conversation, our phone number 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org, to drop us a tweet @MiddayWYPR, to follow me on Twitter @TomHallWYPR. And you can also catch us on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Mary, one of your recommendations in this report about bank lending is to encourage the big banks to do more. So what kind of leverage do we have? What kind of things can we do to encourage greater lending for small businesses?
So I talked about many of the reasons why large banks are more reluctant to make small business loans. But I think we could ask them, for example, to get involved with the SBA, the Small Business Administration, which offers federally guaranteed loans. A bank has to originate the loan, but it's not a high-risk loan for them to make because 85% of the principal is guaranteed by the federal government. You do have to invest in the resources to make these loans, but they are typically larger loans. They are in excess of $200,000. And as we've watched the size of loans decline in Baltimore, as the large banks are typically using credit card lending as a way to give credit to small businesses, the average loan size from our deposit-taking banks is about $70,000, down from close to $200,000 10 years ago. But an SBA-guaranteed loan is over $200,000. So M&T Bank, for example, is the leader in Baltimore making SBA-guaranteed loans. The problem is we're just not making very many of them, and we need to get more banks to invest in the resources to do that. A second idea is to empower community development financial institutions in Baltimore to make small loans to businesses. These are nonprofits. They operate below the level of a bank in terms of the size of lending. But we've seen other cities really effectively increase lending by driving more capital into CDFIs. And a large bank can get Community Reinvestment Act credit by giving capital to a CDFI. They can loan it at a, you know, relatively modest interest rate, get credit for making that sort of investment in underserved markets in the city. So we'd like to see more of that going on. We'd like to strengthen our CDFI network in Baltimore. We have some, but they have historically done mortgage lending, not small business lending. So that's one of our ideas. And finally, I would say that there are public dollars at the state and city level for micro lending to businesses, but they're relatively small. We think a better use of those dollars would be to use them as a loan loss reserve for the private sector to make loans.
So a loan loss reserve.
Okay.
So that's
it.
They make a loan and it goes sour.
Yeah.
And then they lose all their money. There's a thing that backs
them up. A backstop. The way it would work is, let's say a pool of loans has a 10% loss rate. If today the city is making $1 million of microloans to small businesses, they could instead take that million and go to the private sector and say, make $10 million of loans, and our million will backstop a 10% loss rate. And you're using your public dollars differently, but you're getting a lot more leverage, and you're using the loan origination resources and skill of the banking system.
Last year, when you had the first report that came out, we talked about a movement to have, for example, the endowments of some of the large institutions, like the one you're a senior fellow with, Hopkins and University of Maryland and these other big, you know, institutions around the state, use part of their endowment to invest it in businesses, to rather than just, you know, put it in the stock market for General Motors and IBM, but to invest it in businesses. Has that taken hold at all? Any action on that?
We do have some examples of local foundations investing in venture capital. I think the Able Foundation is a good example of that. About 20% of their endowment, I'm told, is invested in local companies. And that's a second area of great interest to us, which is equity capital that's going into small companies to help them grow. And our next report will feature venture capital. We've taken, again, in this case, it's a 12-year retrospective to look back at venture capital flows into small companies in Baltimore. And we've measured about $1.8 billion. And that is a much more positive story than small business lending. We're actually seeing an acceleration of venture capital coming into Baltimore
so
startups.
So venture capital isn't banks. Banks are doing business loans.
Yeah.
But these are individual investors or companies that make it a living, make their living by finding companies that they think are going to succeed and getting down on the ground floor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that situation then seems, and that report will be released later this week, but that seems pretty hopeful then. I mean, are you generally saying
I'm heartened by that. I mean, we're not Silicon Valley here in Baltimore, but everything is moving in the right direction in terms of building a landscape that offers venture capital to small companies and helps them grow here. And the important thing is to keep them here. And as they grow and become revenue producing, they need to grow into a banking system that can provide working capital for them. So it's all connected, if you will, in thinking about a healthy ecosystem for growth. You want to make sure that you're offering the kinds of capital to small businesses and companies when they need it along, you know, their growth trajectory.
The 21st Century Cities Initiative is an initiative at Johns Hopkins. Mary Miller is a senior fellow in this program, and she's been studying the financial situation and the financial system here in Baltimore. She's our guest here on Midday, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org, and our Twitter handle @MiddayWIPR. Let's go to the phones. Dave in Dundalk, welcome to the show with Mary Miller.
Thank you. I spent my life sort of building tech companies. Recently relocated to Baltimore and ended up doing consulting to financial institutions. And one of the things that surprised me was, in doing a lot of small business interviews, was that most of them don't want to grow. Most small, you know, small businesses who want to be successful. They want to have provide a good living for their sole proprietors and small partnerships. But when it comes to really ramping up, you know, unlike my experience, you know, there was not really much appetite for ramping up because it's a wholesale lifestyle change, among other things. So in looking at how do you grow jobs in an area, part of the challenge, as I see it, is to find the needles in the haystack. That is, those successful small companies that really are starved for capital for growth. And curious what if you investigated that, and I'll take my answer off here.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Dave.
I
guess every business is different. Huh?
I think that's a great observation, and I think one of the things we quickly learned was that there are really two kinds of businesses in Baltimore. The first one that you identified, which is not looking to grow excessively or, you know, launch an IPO or something like that. They're not looking for venture capital, but they do need working capital to run their business. The second kind of company is what I would call a high growth company that really is looking to scale, and they need venture capital. What we saw was a growing amount of venture capital coming into Baltimore companies. We tracked 250 or so companies over 12 years. And about, let's see, of that group, 21% failed in over the 12-year period. 66% succeeded and are still in the city of Baltimore today. And about 14% or 12%, 12 to 14% moved out of Baltimore. Those companies are looking to grow and they need capital to grow. Most, meaning more than half of the venture capital dollars coming to Baltimore startups are coming from outside of Baltimore. And that's good news in the sense that outsiders are seeing the value of these companies here. It's bad news in the sense that we're at risk of them leaving Baltimore if they follow the money and go to their funding sources outside of Baltimore. But we're doing a pretty good job of retaining companies, and we need to make sure we continue to make it, as I say, a hospitable environment for these companies.
I want to talk briefly about something you brought up before the break, the Community Reinvestment Act. Mm-hmm. This was a law that was passed in 1977. The original purpose of the law was to combat redlining, which was happening certainly here in Baltimore and in cities across the country. It's a 40-year-old law. And the Trump administration, Mr. Mnuchin at Treasury, really does have his sights set on a big revamp to this. Mm-hmm. What are the kinds of things they're proposing, and what do you think the effect would be here in Baltimore?
So I don't think that they're proposing a legislative change. I don't think they're going to go for legislation. I think this is more likely to happen at the regulatory level. So you'd look at the bank regulators, the OCC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, is actually a part of the Treasury. And they're taking the lead and trying to modernize the Community Reinvestment Act. And I'm all for that in terms of bringing it into today's world of banking and making sure that we're using the data that we can get from the banking system to measure the impact. I think the important thing is not to lose the geographic connection between banking and deposits. A lot of money today.
And that is one of the proposals in terms of the regulation is to take that.
To move to a different model of
criteria.
Of allowing banks anywhere to measure their activity in underserved markets and low and moderate income loans. I think that's important. But I'd like to see them be more explicit about measuring small business lending, which is not specifically called out in the measurements. I also think that asking the financial system to maybe cast the net a bit wider and look at all the kinds of lending that are coming into a city would be a good idea. But it's an opportunity to comment. Right now, there's a paper out asking for comments on the OCC's ideas about modernizing the Community Reinvestment Act. And I think it's a really important debate to have.
We just have a few minutes left. And I want to ask you about your reflections on the financial crisis, which happened 10 years ago. And your perch in this seems to me to be quite unique. You started, when the crisis happened, you were working in the private sector. You were the head of fixed income for T. Rowe Price. Mm-hmm. And then you moved over to the Treasury to fix the problem, and which you did a pretty good job of, it seems, because it got fixed. There are some people who would have liked it to get fixed faster than it did. Yeah. But as you look back, the decisions that were made, both in the Bush administration and the waning days of that administration, the decisions that were made prior to your coming to Treasury, and then you came to Treasury at, what, 2010, something like that?
Beginning of 2010.
So it had been, the crisis had certainly been in effect for a couple of years, and it was a while before we were able to dig out of it. Your thoughts?
Yeah. Well, I think that the financial crisis was certainly one of the most frightening episodes of my career to work through. I think the both administrations, the Bush administration and the Obama administration, did a really good job of stabilizing the financial system. It was deeply unpopular in many quarters, but I think they averted a much worse collapse of the financial system. And I think the result was a lot more financial regulation of the banking system, which has made it safer today, as we discussed earlier, a bit more risk averse in terms of lending, which is
legislation like the Dodd-Frank.
The Dodd-Frank legislation, yeah. I think that what was frustrating is that the financial sector came back quicker than the real economy. And I think that created a lot of dissatisfaction from people wondering why we went to such great lengths to save the financial system when they weren't seeing the benefits in their own lives.
And I think the decision to bail out the banks instead of the people who were holding these mortgages houses were underwater. Yeah. And now, of course, Dodd-Frank, I mean, you were very instrumental in forming and deciding what the Volcker rule should be. We don't want to get in the weeds about all that kind of stuff. But that legislation, certainly in the crosshairs of the people in the Trump administration, there is a movement afoot to deregulate the banks and the system in a way that approaches, I suppose, what it was, where it was in 2008. Does that worry you?
Well, I think we need to keep in mind that no legislation is perfect and there's always room for improvement and recalibration. I watch pretty carefully what's under review and proposal, and they're not proposing, dismantling Dodd-Frank. They're tinkering around the edges. They are recalibrating to provide more relief to smaller institutions. But I'm really heartened to see that some of the big features of it, more capital for banks, more liquidity, less leverage, those are all being left intact. I worry about rolling back some of the protections for consumers at the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, for example. I think that those were important changes to protect small borrowers and retail borrowers.
And, of course, there are those who look at the student loan crisis now, and they predict that that's the next thing that's going to topple the economy in the way that mortgages and the real estate market did 10 years ago. We will just have to see. But, Mary Miller, I appreciate your coming by. This report is really helpful in understanding the system we have here in town, and I'm grateful to you. Thanks.
Thank you, Tom.
Mary Miller served as the Undersecretary for Domestic Finance at the U.S. Treasury during the Obama administration. She was instrumental in the restructuring of the mortgage companies Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the creation and coordination of the Volcker Rule, which was part of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. That's legislation signed into law by President Obama in response to the 2008 financial crisis. Prior to her work at Treasury, she was in senior management at T. Rowe Price, and she's currently serving as a senior fellow in the Johns Hopkins 21st Century Cities Initiative. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up, more on Baltimore Homecoming. Before we take a break, though, every week here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of the people who've been victims of homicide in our city. We do so to stand in witness to their untimely deaths, and we pause for a moment of silence to remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. We get their names from Ellen Worthing, who has compiled a list of Baltimore homicide victims going back 17 years. We also consult the Baltimore Sun's list and the victim identifications that are posted on the Baltimore Police Department's Facebook page. So far in 2018, 231 people in Baltimore City have lost their lives to violence. We had one week last month in which no one was killed, and compared to last year, there have been fewer murders and other crimes in our city. But in the last week of September, 17 people were victims of homicide. The Baltimore Sun reports that just over this last weekend, 7 people were killed and 4 were injured in shootings. Last week, between Saturday the 22nd and Friday the 28th of September, police reported 11 victims of homicide in Baltimore. They are Oliver Santos, age 17. Andre Wims, age 55. Jared Williams, age 34. Anthony Rayner, age 34. Justin Williams Harrison, age 29. Leon Burgess, age 33. Kedrick Moore, age 26. Jonathan Greenidge, age 26. Timothy Morricone, age 25. Beyonce Ellis, age 17. And Danielle Gunson. She was 18 years old. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Nate Lowenthal and J.M. Shapiro join me now in Studio A. They are the co-founders of Baltimore Homecoming. It's a nonprofit organization whose mission is to steer investment to the city by reaching out to some of the prominent artists, entrepreneurs, entertainers who have at one time or another called the city of Baltimore home, as both of these gentlemen do and have done for their entire lives. It's good to meet you both. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
So, Nate, this is an invitation-only event. You identified some folks and you said, we want you to come back home. How come?
Well, you know, for centuries, Baltimore's greatest exports were tobacco or whiskey or steel. But today, our greatest exports are our people. I mean, Baltimoreans around the country are leaders in finance and business. They're artists leading the national conversation on race and politics. They're entertainers. They're athletes. It's an incredible kind of Baltimore diaspora. So our idea was, why not bring these folks home? You know, some of them might have left 5 years ago. Some might have left 50 years ago. Show them what's happening in Baltimore and encourage them to kind of rejoin the life of the city.
And JM, what are you going to show them?
So we have a 3-day program, and we're going to show them sort of all over the city. So we're going to bring them in, and we're going to talk to him. Cal Ripken's going to speak to him about his career in baseball, and then we're going to have Josh Charles come in, and he's going to talk with Sarah Henninger from Thread, and they're going to talk about the good work that she's doing.
Josh is an actor,
Sarah has this wonderful mentoring program. Unbelievable mentoring program called Thread. We're going to highlight some of our homecoming heroes, which we can talk about, and then we're going to take them on field trips. Right, so we're going to take them out to show them what's happening at Station North and what's happening at Center for Urban Families and what's happening in at Hopkins. And then we're going to have a sort of a big gala reception where Tom Rothman, who's the chairman of Sony Motion Picture Group, is going to come. And then Barry Levinson is going to speak about his career in entertainment and how growing up in Baltimore affected that. So
this is an A-list group, to be sure. And is the idea then to say, okay, you come back, you may have forgotten about Charm City, you forgot about where you grew up, but now it's back on your radar screen with the hope that you will use some of your financial resources to invest in businesses and other initiatives, nonprofits, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. And the program is really structured to drive investment. And so we're showing primarily focus on nonprofit organizations. JM mentioned the Center for Urban Families, for example, or Thread, Baltimore Core, and a couple of others. We're doing a bunch of neighborhood revitalization tours. So Station North, we're also going to see the Target Investment Zone in Southeast Baltimore at the Living Classrooms is organized. And then really investment in startups and businesses. And actually, Mary, who was just on, has organized a terrific panel talking about investment in some of the startups in Baltimore. But, you know, it's not just money. I mean, hopefully some of the folks come back. They can write big checks in nonprofits. They'll invest in a venture capital fund focused on Baltimore. But they could bring other resources. They could join the board of an organization and bring expertise to the table. They could see a Baltimore artist and say, you know, this person should be on the national stage. I want to organize a tour for them. They could go home and just talk positively to us. I mean, having folks from Hollywood come here and say, oh, Baltimore would be a cool place to shoot a movie. You know, it's not investment in a direct sense, but it's still good for the city.
And what's the Baltimore brand, JM? I mean, when you bring these folks back, obviously if they haven't been here in 20 or 30 years, you know, or even if they haven't been here in 5 or 10 years, things have changed dramatically since when they lived here. Is Is the brand of Baltimore particularly unique? Pittsburgh, Detroit, Phoenix?
What we found is it's very unique. So when we reached out to all of these people, and finding them wasn't easy, right? So we had to go to every public school and private school and Wikipedia, obviously, and we send them invitations. And all of them would reach back and go, I love Baltimore. I've been looking to try to figure out a way to connect. Right. So what the Baltimore brand is, people have strong feelings for that. It may be from their memories of the Baltimore Colts or the Baltimore Ravens or growing up in the city or working on a nonprofit or going to school here, whatever it may be. And so they're just looking to reconnect. And so to me, the brand is this brand of people are doing great things. There's this national perspective of, sure, there are issues that need to be solved, but people are working on solving those. And so our job is to say, okay, let's highlight some of those people who are solving those issues or working hard to solve those issues so that we can change sort of the perception.
J.M. Shapiro is in the real estate business. Nate Lowenthal is a former special assistant to the president at the National Economic Council in the White House during the Obama administration. They are the co-founders of Baltimore Homecoming. What do you think the brand of Baltimore is? What do you think we should be telling folks when they come back to Baltimore to find out about investment opportunities? 410-662-8780. We are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. You can drop us a tweet at Midday WYPR. You can send us an email, midday@wypr.org. So, Nate, in your work at the White House a few years ago, you led a special task force about Baltimore City, and this grew out of the riots and uprising that we experienced in 2015. What did President Obama want you to achieve, and what were your aspirations there, and what did you find out?
Well, the White House's goal there was really to bring federal investments to bear on the city's priorities. You know, I mean, President Obama's view was, we don't know best, you know, people in Baltimore know best. And so we ended up working closely with some of the leading city agencies, for example, Lena Wen, the health commissioner, now departing, obviously, she had a bunch of really great goals, get funding for safe streets, for example. And so we pushed to find creative ways to get funding for safe streets. There was a big emphasis on infrastructure. The city knew that they had to, you know, rebuild our streets and bridges and roads. So we were able to get funding for North Avenue, for example, to improve, pedestrian safety. But there was not necessarily kind of an overarching vision for the city. But one thing I did learn from that experience was we went around the country to talk to foundations and banks and other national corporations to get help for Baltimore. And the response was, we've been waiting to be asked. And there was this kind of reservoir of goodwill for Baltimore around the country. And that was what in part inspired me to organize the Homecoming with JM, was this idea that people actually care a lot about this city and they just need to be given, you know, clear direction and opportunities to invest. I also had the chance while I was at the White House to see the Detroit Homecoming, which is really the model that we've based this on. And they've held the Homecoming there for 5 years in a row. And they've raised over $240 million investment for Detroit. And I figured, Baltimore's way better than Detroit. You know, we should be able to do at least that. So that was what kind of inspired the effort.
And James Shapiro, you are the CEO of Continental Realty Corporation. Yep. That's a commercial real estate company. What's the commercial real estate market like? I mean, that's one sector of investment and investment opportunities for people who you may be talking to at the end of the week.
Yeah, it's a good question because I'm really a fifth generation Baltimorean. So we purchased our first apartment community in 1972 for $3,000 a unit, literally when rents were $59, right? And so we've seen the growth and the positive momentum for years. And so we believe that the momentum right now is very strong. Like, look at what's happening in the Remington neighborhood, right? And you can clearly, there's always been development around the rim of the harbor, right? Because I can remember when Harbor Place opened. But now it's expanded out to so many different places. You can talk about the Hollins Market and what might be going on there. You know, Nate's father was, the owner of the Culture Pearl, which was a famous restaurant for many, many years. So I think what we're seeing is momentum in areas where there wasn't momentum before. And so our hope would be to sort of open those opportunities up to other people and show them to them.
People, when I talk to folks about the sort of their understanding of Baltimore, they talk about the crime rate as, you know, a central defining criteria for our city. Now, it may not seem after the kind of weekend we just had, in which seven people were murdered and four other people were injured in shootings. It is, however, true that homicides this year are down 15% from last year. So actually, overall, the crime rate is better. But how does that play into that perception of Baltimore, certainly some neighborhoods being super dangerous, play into what you're doing?
Yeah. Well, two thoughts on that. You know, one, it is definitely the case that Baltimore alumni coming back to the city are going to have that at top of mind. They couldn't not. And so we're actually, one of our panels, right when folks arrive, is about community approaches to violence reduction. We have Erica Bridgeford from Ceasefire, Gardnell Carter, who runs a Safe Streets site in McElderry Park, close to my house, actually in Southeast Baltimore, and Molly Baldwin, who's the founder of ROCA, which is going to be starting up its program to kind of reach the hardest folks in the city to try to reduce the murder rate. And so we want to have a frank conversation. Look, this is a real issue in Baltimore, but there are amazing people working every day to improve it. And, you know, the trend line is headed in a good direction right now. You know, the bigger problem is that, as you said, the national perception of Baltimore is shaped profoundly by the crime and violence in the city. And that, I think, has a big impact on, you know, big corporations that might think about opening a regional headquarters in Baltimore, or a tech startup that's thinking about locating here. You know, when you're choosing across cities and you see that Baltimore has this murder rate, you're like, well, why? You know, maybe not the best idea. So part of our goal in the long term with Homecoming is to build this cohort of brand ambassadors, that these people from Baltimore now go home to Chicago or LA or San Francisco and they say, you know, Baltimore's actually a pretty amazing place, and there's more, you know, there's more to the story behind the headlines. And so these folks will start helping get out those positive stories of revitalization and growth of Baltimore.
Let's go to the phones. Jennifer in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Nate Lowenthal and J.M. Shapiro.
Hi there. Yeah, I'm really inspired to hear this idea. This is fantastic. Feels like it really builds team spirit for the city as a whole, and I think we could really use that. And my question was, do you have some ideas about how you're going to have small groups of some of these famous folks to brainstorm and really, there seems like there's a lot of potential for creative ideas to come out of this. I'd just love to hear what you might be thinking of.
To JM?
I mean, I think we have thoughts on how that may come together, but some of it's going to happen naturally when you get 100 or 165 people in the room together and they start talking about what's important to them, right? So somebody's going to hear somebody, a nonprofit leader, and say, wow, that's important to me. And they're going to get their group of friends who they've met at Homecoming and say, can we make a difference there? I think this is the first time we're doing this. So really, you got to think of it almost like a startup, right? And so when you're in a startup, it's an organized startup, and we've done a good job, I think. But what we hope comes out of it is these conversations between these people and between us so that we can lead them to sort of getting more involved.
We have a comment on Twitter. It says, this tour of Baltimore, let us show you our city, is exactly what Donald Schaefer did to get Harbor Place. Great role model for making Charm City shine. Again, I mean, part of this is a branding thing, isn't it, Nate? The part of this is saying, look, you know, you've heard the stories, you've seen the numbers and all that stuff, but Baltimore is more than the stories and the numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. And what we've tried to do is show off a really broad swath of the city. And so folks are headed to West Baltimore, they're headed to East Baltimore, they're headed to South Baltimore. I mean, we're showing there's amazing things happening in every quarter of the city. You know, Hopkins Fast Forward, you know, technology labs, you know, some of the best scientists in the world are working out of there. Center for Urban Families in West Baltimore, I think, is one of the leading, most impactful organizations in the country on helping, you know, returning citizens, you know, coming back from prison. These are national models that need national attention.
But I think, Tom, that Twitter comment is so right, because one of the photos in my opening is of William Donald Schaefer in the aquarium in his bathing suit when we opened up the National Aquarium. That was PR, and I remember it to this day. And so that whoever wrote that, that's exactly one of the things I was thinking about.
Well, God bless and Godspeed. I mean, I think this is really a great idea, and I hope that it's successful, and I hope that this isn't the last one. And clearly you have aspirations to make it an ongoing thing. So appreciate both of you guys coming by and talking about it. Thanks.
Thanks so much for having us.
Nate Lowenthal is the president and founder of Baltimore Homecoming. J.M. Shapiro is Baltimore Homecoming's co-founder and treasurer. He's also the CEO of Continental Realty Corporation. The inaugural Baltimore Homecoming Conference will be held Wednesday through Friday, and we've got stuff on the website about it, wipr.org/ Midday. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's the Midday Culture Connections with Dr. Sherry Parks. We're going to talk about the allegations of sexual assault brought against Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh and how they have once again stirred debate about binge drinking and rape culture on high school and college campuses. We'll talk about that tomorrow on Midday. We want to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington. They feature signature burgers, wings, steaks, and jumbo lump crab cakes. The Diz is open for lunch and dinner with breakfast served on the weekends. They're on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. Thanks for listening here and now. Coming up next, after a break for news at the top of the hour, I'm Tom Hall on behalf of the entire Midday team. Thanks for listening and have a great day.